1895 Sandstone Symposium presents session number 221, Teaching and Promises, an easy-to-read Doctrine and Covenants, not, by Lynn Matthews Anderson.
We're going to start this session right now. This is session 221, Teaching and Promises, an easy-to-read Doctrine and Covenants, by Lynn Matthews Anderson. Lynn graduated from the BYU with a BA in English. She served a mission in Belgium, and right now she's an editor, and she's on the internet. She has three children, three girls, one 12, 10, and 4. And we'll turn the time over to Lynn.
Thank you. Sinners! No, that didn't get them either. Okay. Either come in or go out, or I will have to spew thee out of my mouth. So they were actually supposed to come in. The title of this talk is Teachings and Promises, an Easy-to-Read Doctrine and Covenants? Not. But basically what this is kind of a history of what has happened with the easy-to-read Book of Mormon, and then we'll go on to the Doctrine and Covenants. This is not the same material that I printed on the internet particularly, nor is it the same material that got printed in my article in Sunstone called Delighting in Plainness, although there'll be a little bit of repetition just to bring everybody up to speed. Back in 1988, I began reading the Book of Mormon to my daughters, the oldest of whom was 5 at the time. And, of course, a 5-year-old is just not able to understand the Book of Mormon without a lot of paraphrasing from the reader. And as I was doing this paraphrase, I felt very strongly after the first session that I needed to be writing down the things that I was saying to them. And so right after I was done tucking them in, I went to the computer and started. And my husband, if he were here, would say that I'm just, you know, an incredibly obsessive compulsive person, and once I kind of grab onto something, I just continue with it. So I was at the computer every waking moment, every free moment, and lots of moments that ought to have been devoted to doing other things. It took about 6 months to have something like a reasonably complete draft, and then I kept going over it and going over it and going over it. And the fact that I felt truly inspired to do something like this only augmented my obsessive-compulsive nature. And so and I gave that as kind of the excuse for lots of dinners of takeout pizza and things of that sort. Now, various people have intimated to me that if I had lived in Utah, I would have known that I was dealing with a potato, that this was something that would be controversial and that it wouldn't stand a chance of getting off the ground. And I guess, in retrospect, I'm kind of pleased that I lived in the unenlightened East because of some of the results of the easy-to-read Book of Mormon for a lot of different people. But since I was unaware of what was going on, I cruised through this draft, and in my enthusiasm for the project, about 3 months into it, I announced on one of the Mormon electronic mailing lists, at that time it was called internet.lds, but now it's called LDSnet, I announced that I was doing this project. Now, the responses to this announcement ranged from many enthusiastic cries of, "It's about time," to more cautious wait-and-see willingness to consider the matter. A few people were perturbed at the idea of my intention to use gender-inclusive language. A few people were suspicious about anyone doing anything which had prior official approval. And one or two others voiced concerns about what they called dummying down the scriptures. Only one person tried to command me to cease and desist, alluding to his priesthood right to do so, and only one person tried to blackmail me. So even though I didn't know that what I was doing was politically incorrect from an official standpoint, I did find out relatively early on that not everyone was going to greet this with open arms. And I probably already had an inkling that there might be some difficulty because we are, after all, the church that continues to use the King James Version of the Bible. But suffice to say that the electronic response was sufficiently favorable that I felt even more strongly motivated to continue with the project. Now, during the course of working on the first draft, I became aware of an entire population, besides children such as my own, who could benefit from the work I was doing, specifically the functionally illiterate and learning disabled among us. In September of 1993, the U.S. Department of Education issued its findings about illiteracy in this country alone. 90 million adults, or 47% of the adult population, demonstrate low levels of literacy in the English language, even though most adults questioned describe themselves as being able to read or write English well or very well. In other words, they didn't even know they couldn't read well. An additional 61 million adults, 31 to 32%, demonstrated skills in the middle literacy level, which leaves only about 34 million to 40 million adults, that's 18 to 21%, who are fully capable of reading with any degree of significant comprehension all portions of the Authorized Book of Mormon, which tests out at the 12th grade reading level or higher for complexity and difficulty. Of course, 1 week later, the Department of Education released another study which said that two-thirds of all American children are not reading up to their grade level. So we may be placing 2 million copies of the Book of Mormon a year, but statistically fewer than half of those who own it are capable of reading it. And although things didn't seem statistically quite so bad when I began the project, this was 5 years before the Department of Education made these interesting announcements, I did run across people even in my own ward who were very interested in what I was doing. The bishop of my ward asked if he could use portions of the first draft to help a young man who had difficulty reading prepare himself for a mission. And he had felt that the young man had felt that he really couldn't go unless he had a grasp of what the Book of Mormon was all about. And I'm sure some of you are aware that President Monson, when he was a mission president, had a young elder who had come to him in tears saying he couldn't read the Book of Mormon. He told him to go read Dita Peterson Neely's A Child's Story of the Book of Mormon to get at least some kind of a rough idea of what the Book of Mormon was about and thereby acquire a testimony. So it isn't that people are not necessarily unaware that there is a problem. Now, about me and the Book of Mormon, Now, I see Sister Roper in the audience here, and she was in my ward in Tarzana when I was growing up. And I don't know if you remember this or not, but I was one of those obnoxious kids who would always have the answer in Sunday school, and I was always very interested in religion, and especially in our own religion. And I had read the Book of Mormon at least a dozen times by the time I turned 12. Now, with how much comprehension, who can say? But, and I love to Bible bash with Jehovah's Witnesses and fundamentalist Christians, which activity continued up until my mission when I learned that it was kind of futile to be a party to a contest of religionists. Nevertheless, my familiarity with the scriptures coupled with my training as an editor, I think really served me in good stead to be able to do this with some degree of competence. Just before I got my bachelor's degree, I worked on a project with several of the faculty at BYU, simplifying the English language discussions. We cut them from 18,000 words to 12,000 words, took them from the 12th grade reading level to the 6th grade reading level, and these were used, apparently, as the basis for a new simplified Spanish translation of the missionary discussions. So I had very specific experience in simplifying fairly complex work. Back in 1988, I had the opportunity to chat with my area president at the time, who then was Elder John Carmack. He was somebody that I knew somewhat superficially. He had served in the Los Angeles area as the president of the Southern California Mormon Choir, or I guess more accurately, the priesthood advisor. He was my parents' lawyer before his call to church service. So he knew who I was, and I knew who he was, although we didn't really know each other very well. He came through Pittsburgh, and I had the opportunity to tell him about my project, and he was very interested. I sent him some excerpts, and I received this response. "Dear Lynn, it was so good to see you again, and I appreciated receiving your letter. I will shop around your outstanding idea among the brethren and see if there is any interest in such a project. In the meantime, I encourage you in your work. It has a wonderful feeling and seems to be something much needed. I would very much appreciate receiving a copy of the draft when it is completed. And then at the bottom, end quote, there was a handwritten note on the bottom of this letter which said, received some feedback indicating a lack of interest in officially pursuing it. Well, once it was clear that it wasn't a passing interest on my part, I notified President Thomas S. Monson and Elder Dallin Oaks about it. And I had heard from some of my friends at BYU that these brethren were sympathetic to such a project. This is the official response I received, dated the 29th of August, 1988, signed by F. Michael Watson, Secretary to the First Presidency. Dear Sister Anderson, I have been asked to acknowledge your letter dated July 16, 1988, to President Thomas S. Monson about a proposed modern English edition of the Book of Mormon. I have also been asked to explain that after reviewing the matter, it is the decision of the First Presidency that the Church not become involved in the production or publication of such an edition. Further, in accordance with current policy, neither can the Church provide you with any endorsement for your project. The brethren also asked me to thank you for sharing your ideas with them and to extend their love and best wishes to you, end quote. About a year later, Elder Carmack was again in Pittsburgh, and he encouraged me to write to the First Presidency again. This was the response on September 15, 1989. Quote, Dear Sister Anderson, I have been asked to acknowledge your... Again, this was by F. Michael Watson. I have been asked to acknowledge your letter of September 5th, 1989 to a member of the First Presidency about a simplified version of the Book of Mormon on which you are working. The curriculum department previously shared with the brethren a careful review of your proposal, which was first submitted to them a year ago. As noted in our letter to you of August 29th, 1988, the Church has no interest in publishing a simplified version of the Book of Mormon. It is felt that Holy Writ should be kept in the form in which it was first translated. The brethren ask me to extend their best wishes to you, end quote. Now, I will not at this point talk about the irony of keeping Holy Writ in the form in which it was first translated. You know, there are certain changes between the first, second, and third editions of the Book of Mormon. But the point I want to make is that neither Elder Carmack, nor my stake president, nor my bishop at the time construed the two letters from the First Presidency as any kind of mandate, order, or even suggestion to me to cease working on the project. In fact, this appears to be what Elder Carmack's understanding was in a letter dated September 22, 1989. Dear Lynn, it was so good to hear from you. Shirley and I took your selections from the Book of Mormon on our trip and read it over together. I can certainly see some strong benefits in this, but apparently the First Presidency is not interested in being involved in it. What you do, you will have to do privately or through a publisher. I wish you well in it and offer my personal congratulations for a great idea and a job well done, end quote. So up through 1991, there apparently was no problem with my project or my working on the project. In fact, several people suggested I contact the church educational system about my work, and a couple who were on a literacy mission to Chicago. I got in touch with them through a friend who had lived in Chicago. They ended up using portions of my work with their investigators and new members and reported that those people were overjoyed to be able to read the Book of Mormon for themselves. Later on that same year, I ended up meeting with the functionary in charge of adult literacy materials for the church educational system. Now, this was in August 1991, having sent them previously a draft to study. And it coincided, my interview with this person coincided with my talk on delighting in plainness that I gave at the Sunstone Symposium here. Now, this was a very odd interview, to say the least. The brother's first words on our being introduced were, quote, "My, aren't you young and pretty," end quote. And although I was taken aback at this kind of unprofessional greeting and demeanor, I managed to keep a civil tongue in my head and kept the purpose of the meeting in mind. Now, the first part of the meeting consisted of the brother essentially sniffing me out, as it were. He'd tried to figure out if I was a nutcase, I guess, or trying to set up my own church or something like that. And then after these searching questions, he kind of started talking about other things, and then he'd come and say something like, "I'm just a country boy from Layton. You're very spiritual, aren't you?" And, "Well, I wouldn't know about these things. You're smart, aren't you?" It was just a really weird combination of flattery and self-deprecation. And by the time he actually got around to discussing my manuscript, he'd pretty much used up all of his credibility with regard to superlative language. But he did say, and I guess I'm willing to believe in that, he and his superiors thought that I had done a very good job. The upshot of the meeting was threefold. First, I found out that the church educational system itself had tried to do something in-house along the same lines that I had done, but had failed to win the First Presidency's approval. And this was apparently a project quite apart from another project that went on to try to produce some kind of a gloss for translators to use, and that's a whole separate project. Secondly, the church educational system wasn't going to be able to help me get my manuscript officially approved by the church or any such thing. And third, the brother gave me a British Petroleum pen as a souvenir of my visit. And he also took me on a brief tour and took me up to the observation deck on the 26th floor and pointed out various burial sites and so forth. Those of you who have seen Jesus of Montreal, you know, I rather expected him to say, you know, all this will be yours if you'll worship me, but anyway. As we were parting, I don't know, those of you who have been to the church office building, the elevators go to the 14th floor, some of them anyway, and he was getting off at the 14th floor and I was going to continue on to the lobby. And just as he's getting off, he says, "Well, it's just too bad about your Sunstone connection." You know, and the doors are closing. What about this? You know. I didn't realize that there would be various fringe people that, you know, in back east, you don't get, you know, the polygamous groups and other people with their tables in the lobby and stuff. But anyway, it was interesting. But even though the church was not going to be involved in any way, there was nothing amiss, as far as anyone that I knew could tell, in my proceeding. And likewise, after the Relief Society announced its sesquicentennial literacy project, I wrote to Elaine Jack and offered my work for use in the project. You know, I've offered the church repeatedly the manuscript. You know, I didn't want any money, and if they wanted to take my name off of it, that would be fine. This was something that I had done specifically to be helpful. And besides, the laborer in Zion should labor for Zion and not for money, and that's basically the way I felt about this the whole time. Anyway, she replied and thanked me and said she'd pass on the information to the literacy committee, and, of course, I haven't really heard anything since. Now, I mentioned in my Sunstone article 2 years ago that I had approached Avram Gileadi for help with the Isaiah portions of the Book of Mormon, and given the events of that particular fall, I'm grateful that he didn't have time to work with me on this project. All was quiet on the Western Front until November of 1992, when I received a telephone call from Peggy Fletcher Stack, religion editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. "Was I aware," she asked, "that there was a man, one Timothy B. Wilson of Lehi, who was about to go to press with a work he was planning on calling Mormon's Book?" Mormon's Book had been my original title. I was not aware. She'd found out about me only because she'd run into Elbert Peck and mentioned the story she was working on, and he'd given her a copy of my Sunstone presentation. Now, I wasn't happy with the idea that Tim Wilson was going to usurp the title of my book. There were some kind of weird connections. Avram Gileadi's wife was his editor, and so I thought, you know, surely they would know that this was happening. But after speaking with him a couple times on the phone, I decided, you know, he was above board. And we ultimately exchanged some ideas and data files. Now, I felt there were serious problems with his book, stylistically and interpretively, and I gave him a detailed critique of his first chapter, Nephi 1, you know, pointing out certain problems. If you're paraphrasing, you don't change from third person to first person and all, you know, various things. Be that as it may, he did end up printing his book, and he was punished for it. I don't know if he's still under punishment, but he was denied a temple recommend, and he was very much afraid that they would do something more to him than simply keep him from the temple. I've lost track of him since. The book did not sell well, and there may be some reasons for that, although I think the marketing of it and its very size kind of worked against it, plus its price. Now, I didn't hear anything more about anything until the First Presidency's letter appeared in the Church News in February of 1993, stating that modern English versions of the Book of Mormon were not authorized. Now, I didn't know precisely what to make of this announcement, and I didn't know for sure if it applied to what I was doing. I understood the idea of the church's proprietary concerns and how they would not want people to think that something coming out about the Book of Mormon or paraphrasing the Book of Mormon would be, they didn't want anyone to construe that this was some kind of an official document or official paraphrase. So that was fine. Now, I personally, I'd never sought the church's authorization, endorsement, or approval. I'd only offered them the work. And so part of me was thinking, well, is this a non sequitur, or does this apply to me, or what? At that time, I was again featured in a brief article in the Salt Lake Tribune in which I was quoted, I'd say paraphrased, as saying I didn't know if the announcement pertained to my work, and I certainly hoped that what I had done would not be seen as improper and so forth. Now, the statement, one does not lightly critique First Presidency statements, but I do believe there were several problems with this one, the most serious of which was its failure to address the ever-growing problem of people's inability to read the authorized edition. And I went for several weeks puzzled by all the brouhaha, and maybe this is where I made a tactical error, however. I sent copies of a spiral-bound draft to the First Presidency, Quorum of the Twelve, and the Presidents of the Auxiliaries. Now, it wasn't necessarily a mistake to send them copies of it. Perhaps the mistake was the letter that I sent preceding my sending them the copies. I did not receive any acknowledgement of anyone receiving any books, not even from the auxiliary presidents, and they always respond to everything. And I don't know if anyone of the brethren ever received the copies. I did say in my letter, asking for some clarification, I also asked a kind of rhetorical question about who would be responsible for denying people, I'm paraphrasing here since I don't have the copy of my letter, who would be responsible for denying functionally illiterate people the opportunity to read the message of the Book of Mormon in their own language, in other words, simple English. And, you know, it's possible that even though I thought it was a diplomatic letter and all of this sort of thing, maybe somebody got their nose bent out of shape. In any event, you know, to me it's certainly possible that everything got intercepted and that nobody's ever read it on that level. On the other hand, maybe they read it and they didn't like it, or who knows? I'll never know, or it seems like I won't ever know. In any event, after having learned that Tim Wilson had had his membership threatened, in early April of 1993, I felt strongly impressed that I should donate the copyright and distribution rights to the Sunstone Foundation, thereby removing any legal control I might have over the manuscript, and I did so immediately. 2 months later, on June 6th, I was asked to meet with my stake president and was told that he had received a phone call from Salt Lake instructing him to tell me not to promote nor distribute the easy-to-read Book of Mormon. No reason was given. In fact, at first, the stake president wouldn't even tell me who had given him this directive. I later found out that my area president, Creel Coford, had made the phone call, but it is still not clear to me who gave him his marching orders. Vague, nebulous references to the office of the First Presidency without a name attached seems kind of, well, it's difficult. I explained to my stake president that I didn't have legal control of the manuscript, and my article about the work was that very week arriving in 10,000 mailboxes of Sunstone subscribers. And he gave me permission to direct all inquiries about the work to the Sunstone Foundation, which I did. I thought, well, if this was an inspired decision, somebody's inspiration was just a tad late. I asked both my stake president, Ralph Seebach, and my area president to try to arrange for me to see a member of the First Presidency, which I would do at my request, but my request was denied. And while I was in Salt Lake in August of 1993, I ended up seeing my area president, which I really didn't see the point of doing. It was at the behest of my stake president. My husband went with me, and our thinking was that we would go and see if we could persuade him to help us get an appointment to see, you know, a real decision maker in this, a member of the First Presidency. Our discussion with him was fruitless and unsubstantive, to put it mildly. He was, you know, at first very grandfatherly, and then he would visibly harden whenever we came close to discussing our feelings of having been treated as though we had done something wrong. He likened all that had gone on as my having invested in a snuff factory the day before Joseph Smith received the Word of Wisdom, which is an interesting thing, the Book of Mormon as tobacco, and indicated that as far as he was concerned, it would make absolutely no difference to his way of thinking, even if my paraphrase were 100% doctrinally correct, and even though, as he tacitly admitted, there's an obvious need for such a thing. He had not read the work, by the way. He made it clear that one simply does not argue with a directive from the First Presidency. And again, hearkening back to the statement itself, the statement says, and I'll read a couple of portions, they go into how many Books of Mormon have been translated and published and so forth. From time to time, there are those who wish to rewrite the Book of Mormon into familiar modern English. We discourage this type of publication and call attention to the fact that the Book of Mormon was translated by the gift and power of God, who has declared that it is true. And they go into when a sacred text, they talk about trying to guard against doctrinal errors in translation, which, you know, even with apostolic oversight, you know, there are lots of people, anybody who reads a foreign language can probably point out places in foreign language editions of our sacred scriptures, places where the translation is a bit iffy. There are a couple places in French, there are serious problem in German, and I've heard that there are other problems in other languages. But interestingly enough, you know, we brought up the idea that I had given the manuscript to the brethren, and I was perfectly happy to make any changes that they might propose, in fact, more than happy. And then my area president said something about how I just wanted them to act as my editors. Well, you know, what can you do? If you give them the manuscript it was a very disturbing kind of interview. I felt that if he'd been told to shoot us by somebody in authority over him, he would have done so with no questions asked. Since he would not call to try to make an appointment for us with a member of the First Presidency, he said, oh, you can try to do so yourselves, and, you know, without an introduction from your file leader, you don't get in. Now, my response to this at the time was that, you know, I had been above board. I had kept my priesthood leaders informed at all levels. I had offered the work to Salt Lake repeatedly. I kept them informed. I didn't do any of this in the dark. They had my name and address on file. And a lot of people on lots of different levels had been very happy and enthusiastic about this work. If I were to have utilized my area president's analogy, perhaps I did invest in a snuff factory the day before Joseph Smith received the word of wisdom, but I felt I was following scriptural and fairly explicit priesthood counsel to make such an investment. And furthermore, if the First Presidency discourages such a work, they certainly didn't do it with me early on. I was very disturbed by the fact that I couldn't talk to anybody who could actually do anything about this, and sometimes I wonder about the channel system. Now, let me tell you a little bit about how it finally came to be published. There was lots of interest early on with the LDS publishing houses. Deseret Book was interested, but they said that, you know, they knew it would sell well, they thought it would be a great thing. But because of the nature of the product, that it was going to be like a translation of the Book of Mormon, they had to have the First Presidency's go-ahead. I have a very nice rejection letter from Eleanor Knowles about it. Signature Book was, the board of Signature Book was evenly divided on whether to publish or not. Unfortunately, tie does not go to the author. The philosophical reason for the members who didn't want to do it was that I did not have the original source materials, by which I guess they meant the golden plates. And no, I did not have the golden plates. nor did I have a Urim and Thummim or anything else. Yeah. Gary Bergera, who's the president, he wrote me a very nice rejection letter saying that usually he agrees with the board, but this time he thought that the decision was not right, that it would sell well and so forth and so on. Anyway, I went through the round of publishing houses. I got a really weird response from Bookcraft, something like, we can't do it, and we hope you understand why. Goodbye. And it was, so I basically ended up kind of giving up after a while. You know, I didn't have the resources to do more than a very small, a 300-copy, perfect bound edition, and, you know, I just didn't have any resources to really turn to. However, last November, this is November 1994, I got a call from Alan Birch out of the blue, and he said, I hear you've done a simple English Book of Mormon, and I want to publish it. And he was going to be in Boston on business, and so we arranged to meet the next week. And he had said that, you know, he's a young father, and he has young kids, and he had been reading the Book of Mormon to his children. And he was very frustrated. I guess it was hard for him to paraphrase on the fly. And he had decided that he was going to hire somebody to do a simple English Book of Mormon. Run into somebody in Chicago, who had heard about what I'd done or knew about what I'd done and said, oh, it's already been done. And he managed to track me down. And so we met, and by that time the copyright had reverted. Sunstone had had a certain amount of time that they had to try to get it published. They almost got it published through Siegel, and then Siegel had its incredible upheaval. I hear it's a very acrimonious, unpleasant kind of thing that happened, and lots of manuscripts, including my own, got lost in the shuffle. Anyway, so I had the copyright back, and so I ended up signing the book over to Estes Book Company, which was created pretty much specifically to print the easy-to-read Book of Mormon, although it sounds like they've had enough fun doing this, I'll put fun in quotes, I can't imagine, that they want to publish other Mormon-oriented books, so that might continue. So the book, they did a really quick job on it, but they did a pretty good job. I had about 4 days to go through the blue line, and I did a complete revision before that. So we've had about 8 complete revisions and a number of other minor revisions to the manuscript, complete drafts, where I sit down with the authorized version and go through verse by verse with my simplified thing to make sure I hadn't gotten anything too fouled up. I'd also released the easy-to-read Book of Mormon over the internet, and people could download an earlier version of it, and I got feedback. You know, some people would point out typos, some people would say, do you really mean to say this? And I'd go back and look and say either yes or no, maybe I got that wrong. But I think one of the nicest things that I've gotten from this project, from even the small press release that I had, the 300 copies and the previously a spiral-bound version of 200 copies, is some of the comments from people, particularly parents. I had parents of learning disabled teenagers who have told me how their kids are able to keep up with the Book of Mormon study in seminary because they've been using a simple English Book of Mormon. I've heard from people, I had a couple people yesterday come up to me and say, you know, my 11-year-old, my 10-year-old are really enjoying this. You know, one was afraid that her daughter was going to turn off on the Book of Mormon entirely, and so she got this, and her daughter loved it and read it all through and really liked it. But for me personally, this happened just before we went on vacation a couple weeks ago. My oldest daughter, who's now 12, who has been reading the easy-to-read Book of Mormon, came up to me and she was telling me how she was just about all the way through 3rd Nephi and that she really liked it and that furthermore she could feel the Spirit when she read my book. And so if nobody else were to get any benefit from it or if nobody else were to like it, that was why I did this, was so that my children would be able to read the Book of Mormon and understand it for themselves. And I'm gratified that for my oldest daughter and my 10-year-old is about to launch into it, that it's been helpful to them to understand the message of the Book of Mormon. One quote I'd like to share that I got from a woman in Ohio is that I have a son with mild mental retardation who is trying very hard to read the Book of Mormon. He says, I just can't get through Alma, Mom. I'm not sure what he understands. You are doing a wonderful service. There are plans right at the moment. Somebody is currently working on a Spanish translation of an easy-to-read Book of Mormon, using the easy-to-read as the basis for it. Hermano Gomez has at least as much difficulty as Brother Brown in reading the antiquated Spanish and so forth. So there have been some positive results. The reviews have been, what reviews there have been kind of interesting. Those of you who get the review of books on the Book of Mormon will note that there were two that dealt with the easy-to-read Book of Mormon, plus a little comment by the editor of the volume. Now, the editor of the volume, which is Daniel C. Peterson, talks about how he's not certain that the message of Scripture is entirely reducible to propositions that can be abstracted from its revealed language. Its complexity may well be part of its message, and so forth and so on. Marvin Folsom had a very nice review. What is her name? Camille Wilson didn't like either Tim Wilson's or mine, and she said, these books are hard for me to read, particularly the Matthews Anderson version. This is in part a philosophical disagreement. I do not believe that the Scriptures comprise a body of information which we are to decode, process, and pray about. Well, gee, I thought, that's an interesting statement. Then what the heck are the Scriptures for? if we're not to decode, process, and pray about the messages therein. So, yes, we do, in fact, have a deep philosophical disagreement about what the purpose of the scriptures are. Moreover, just as with the First Presidency Statement, the two reviews that I have seen thus far that I would characterize as negative, or, well, this review and then the comment about the review in the preface to this, to the robot bomb, as we call it, is that they miss the point. I agree that the Hebraisms, the chiasmus, and parallel structures, and the complexity of the language, and so forth and so on, well, that may, in fact, help prove the Book of Mormon to a particular audience or mindset. But it's of little use to the 90-plus million people who can't even negotiate the words and the sentence structure, let alone have any kind of appreciation for these kinds of linguistic proofs of authenticity. You know, what do we do about people who just can't read? Well, we're waiting. You know, the church does have the literacy project, and they try to use the scriptures to teach people how to read. Well, there are some difficulties using complex texts to teach people to read. And again, what do you do with people who want to do it themselves, particularly kids who are too old for the little comic book version and yet not sophisticated enough with their reading skills to be able to deal with the authorized version? There's simply nothing out there, nothing, that deals with any kind of doctrine, the doctrinal exposition in the Book of Mormon. One other thing I want to mention is that I did have some small side benefit to my having done this project personally, and that was that I know the Book of Mormon really well. I read it for the Easy to Read project about 100 times, and then about 50 times afterwards as I launched into a new project, which was, those of you who read Dialogue last summer, I wrote an article that briefly touched on some of my work, which was entitled Toward a Feminist Interpretation of Latter-day Scripture. And in that, I talk about there are significant theological implications dealing with women's exclusion from our books of sacred scripture, and that it suggests to me that the Book of Mormon context for, vis-a-vis women is so entirely different from our own that the Book of Mormon can't be used to support contemporary doctrine and practice relative to women. In fact, to me, our sacred texts give great reason to call into question certain aspects of the status quo. To say, for example, that women should not hold priesthood because Book of Mormon women, to all evidence, did not, is simply a non-argument because, after all, you cannot even prove that women were baptized using the Book of Mormon text, or that they received the Holy Ghost or partook of the sacrament or did anything that modern LDS women see as a perfectly normal course of their membership in the church. Now, this was very startling to me. I hadn't realized that this was the case, but, you know, I went on through the Doctrine and Covenants and so forth. And, you know, women are even more scarce in the Doctrine and Covenants than in the Book of Mormon. So, to me, the very basis for traditional interpretation of LDS as it pertains to women is fundamentally flawed and prevents us from seeking new revelation to old problems, such as the relationship of women to saving ordinances, to priesthood ordination, to church governance, and even to God. You can't find anything in our scriptures, essentially, about these questions. In the context of the time and cultures represented, such questions weren't even comprehended, much less formulated or answered. So this launched me into all sorts of feminist theology and exegesis and hermeneutics and all this stuff, and I've had an interesting time becoming more familiar with some of those issues. Now, the latest, greatest stuff that has been happening, and this will be new to everybody, Alan Birch did call me and ask me if I would consider doing a simple English Doctrine and Covenants. And, you know, I had to just laugh, you know, great. There's already been enough fallout from the Easy to Read Book of Mormon, that's, you know, why would I do this? But, you know, he did ask, and I took a look at it to see how, you know, how such a thing would fare. And I came to the conclusion that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to do a paraphrase similar to what I did with the Easy to Read Book of Mormon for a number of reasons. one of which is that the language of the Doctrine and Covenants is far more sophisticated and precise and more highly nuanced and stylized than what's found in the easy-to-read Book of Mormon. And secondly, you know, of course, the Doctrine and Covenants doesn't have a historical narrative. It does not have any storylines either. Those were certainly the easiest sections to deal with in the Book of Mormon itself, were the history kinds of things. So, you know, it's got a couple strikes against it. And then what would you do with something like, I kept thinking, well, okay, I kept looking at different sections and, you know, kind of running a paraphrase through my mind. Here's Doctrine and Covenants 88, verse 40. For intelligence cleaveth unto intelligence, wisdom receiveth wisdom. Well, what am I going to say? Because intelligence sticks to intelligence, you can retain some grandeur of language, I think, in the Book of Mormon, but you sure can't do it with places in the Doctrine and Covenants. Just try it out sometimes. Go through just about any section, and you'll go, oh, well, this would be very, very hard to say simply, and yet still carry with it the kind of impact that we'd hope that Scripture would have. So I pretty much said there's no way to do that. I think the best that anyone could hope to do on the Doctrine and Covenants would be to have kind of a running simplified commentary that would take a couple of sections. You know, not all sections of the Doctrine and Covenants are equally valuable, low be it spoken. And to take the most important sections, the section 76, 88, 84, 121, some of the ones that are really key to the way that the church was governed and organized, and go through them pretty much verse by verse, do some simplification, but basically make it just a comment that person with reading difficulty could negotiate. So if that ever, in all my free time, now that I'm back to work full time and so forth, if that ever happens, it will truly be a miracle. The Pearl of Great Price, on the other hand, might be kind of fun to do, but I think I'm out of the paraphrasing business for the moment. Have to tackle the history of the church or something like that sometime. Now, the book, the easy-to-read Book of Mormon, is having an interesting time in the market. I've asked the publisher, after this latest round, I finally just asked the publisher, I don't want to know about this stuff anymore. It just upsets me. I can't do anything about it. I don't want to be involved in the marketing and so forth. I don't mind, appearing and doing book signings and stuff. Don't tell me the business stuff. It just drives me crazy. They had a terrible time finding an LDS distributor that wasn't afraid of offending the brethren. They finally did procure one. However, the employee that was put in charge of the distribution project had a bee in her bonnet, apparently, and kept telling bookstores that were running out of it that it was out of print, that it wasn't available. There was this problem. It was the work of an interesting individual and apparently not something directed from a certain large building in this area. Although at first we had no idea. However, other strange events have happened. One of the larger LDS-related publishers that has a book club had agreed to put in flyers about the easy-to-read Book of Mormon in one of its monthly mailers to its membership. 2 days after the deal was struck, they wouldn't even talk to Estes Book again, period. So where is the pressure coming from? I don't know. I can guess. I've got plenty of cynicism to believe where it probably is coming from, that people would construe the idea that something isn't authorized to the idea that you need to suppress it through any means possible. My feeling is this, that if it fills a need, fine. Let it fill the need. Let it either fall or fly on its own merits or lack of merit. But live and let live doesn't seem to be the name of the game. My own feeling, I've made up these little flyers for various places, and I ended up writing this particular little message so that the publisher could kind of give things to various distributors and bookstore owners. So they could kind of get the idea of who this Lynn Matthews Anderson person was and so forth. And my last paragraph in this letter says that the easy-to-read Book of Mormon is no replacement for Joseph Smith's inspired translation. Yet the Book of Mormon itself tells us that if something persuades people to do good and to believe in Christ, then it is of Christ, Moroni 7, 13-18. I've tried my best to keep that criterion uppermost in mind throughout this project, And it's my sincere hope that the easy-to-read Book of Mormon will be a tool to help persuade those with limited reading skills to do good and to believe in Christ. Now, that is the criterion on which, by which I would want the easy-to-read Book of Mormon to be judged. It's politically incorrect now. I kept getting encouraging comments from my bishop in Pittsburgh that, you know, 10, 20 years down the line, this will, you know, people will have it. It'll be all over the place. I've gotten copies of different versions of the Book of Mormon from a really interesting illustrated Book of Mormon that has the most fantastic headdresses for all of the chief judges of the land. You know, somebody's wearing an entire cow head or something on their head. And it's a fascinating volume. I just, wow. But it doesn't change any of the text. It just illustrates everything in a really interesting and colorful way. And then there are other versions. There was a book published, A Voice from the Dust. This was published back, I think, in the 1930s. Anyway, I finally got a copy of that. And there's a nice preface from Joseph Fielding Smith, who at the time was a church historian, and he was praising this thing to the skies. It got rid of "and it came to pass" and all the Isaiah sections, but for the rest of it, it left everything else pretty much intact. And so Joseph Fielding Smith is saying, anything that will help our young people learn the message of the Book of Mormon, well, you know, more power to it. Obviously, that attitude has changed over time. And I'm not really sure why. I realize that the form of the Book of Mormon to some people has been just a wonderful proof of its authenticity. But whenever we prefer form over substance, then we end up promoting idolatry. We end up being as bad as the biblical inerrantists. And we end up, you know, defeating the purpose. The Book of Mormon can change people's lives, but they have to be able to understand its content. Whether or not they understand that, Lehi has used Hebrew poetry when he talks to Laman and Lemuel about the river and the valley and so forth, well, those are nice things to know, but they're kind of peripheral to the idea that there are things in the Book of Mormon that teach us to become more like Christ. I believe that when we do this sort of thing, we end up remaining under the condemnation that God spoke in Doctrine and Covenants 84:54-58, which says, "Your minds in times past have been darkened by unbelief, and because you have treated lightly the things you have received, which vanity and unbelief have brought the whole church under condemnation, and this condemnation resteth upon the children of Zion, even all. They shall remain under condemnation until they repent and remember the new covenant, even the Book of Mormon, and the former commandments which I have given them, not only to say but to do according to that which I have written, that they may bring forth fruit meet for their father's kingdom. Otherwise there remaineth a scourge and judgment to be poured out upon the children of Zion." I fully believe that some of the scourge and judgment is reflected in some of the controversy and the instances of spiritual abuse which we have heard of at this symposium and in others and in other places. Personally, you know, I'm still active in my ward. I teach the 16 and 17-year-old Sunday school class, which has most of the bishop's children in it. I still attend church. It's been difficult for my family. My siblings, except for the one who's never active, are still all participating. But they are confused, and they wonder about all of the stuff that has happened because of the easy-to-read Book of Mormon. They've read it, and they don't see any problem with it. They've had their stake presidents and bishops read it, even as I have had my presidents, stake presidents and bishops have copies of it, and they don't see anything wrong with it. In fact, they think it's good. They think it serves a useful function. Whether or not it will ever trickle up to anybody who has enough authority to make changes, it's anyone's guess. I just wish I kind of had those 18 copies back, because it cost me a bundle to send them to them. But and now they're really rare now, so, gee, you know, collector's items. I still believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ. I have certain problems with the authoritarian stuff going on in the church, but I still believe in the salvation that Jesus Christ offers, and I still believe that the Book of Mormon is the Word of God. And I believe most strongly that all people have the right to partake of this salvation by hearing or reading the Book of Mormon in their own language, whether it's Swahili, Ukrainian, Cantonese, or late 20th century English. My sin, in short, was that I took the Book of Mormon seriously, and I still do. Thank you.
We have about 9 minutes if you want to have any questions.
In the back. Okay.
Comment, question.
No, it well, and that's been a problem, an increasing problem. I was teaching seminary, home study seminary. You meet once a week, and I was using the King James Version and the New Revised Standard Version, and some elders, missionary guy came by with his companion. He was appalled, that I would actually use a different version than the King James. So I asked him to pronounce S-H-E-W, and he said shoo, and I said, show. And then he shut up and went away. Even in the Doctrine and Covenants, those on the internet will, remember the great debate about the word of wisdom. What do certain phrases mean? To be used in times of famine. There's this phrase that we can interpret one way, but in Joseph Smith's time was used entirely differently. And what does the word betimes, reproving betimes with sharpness? Well, a lot of people, and I myself included, I thought betimes meant, from time to time. Well, it doesn't. It means like frequently or something. So there are even words in the 19th century that just don't come across very well in the late 20th. I assume that eventually the need for the church to get the message across will overcome, our linguistic conservatism. We're still into this, thee, thy, thou stuff, and I've heard even general authorities giving prayers at general conference mangle the usage. We seem to want to preserve things that aren't necessarily worth preserving in the overall scheme of things. I hope that eventually some of the brethren who will eventually filter up, who have seen that there is a clear need, will make some changes along those lines. I don't say that mine's the last word on, that the easy to read would be anything that the church would ever officially adopt. I would just hope they just let it alone and let it either sell or not sell. That there has been pressure put on publishers, distributors, individual bookstore owners, and so forth. I think that's reprehensible and completely unnecessary. You over there, that's right. You over there, Becky.
I have to give a testimony. I've got the
industry
book along
with the parents. What are the publishing stats on it? Is it first run? And how many?
There were 3,000 copies printed in this first print run. I do not know how well it's doing, although I've heard Alan Birch, the publisher, has said that he's happy with the response thus far, and however many have been sold, it's been without a, they haven't, this is the first time. I did a radio interview in St. George and a newspaper interview in St. George the beginning of the week, and I'll do a book signing tonight and here at Sunstone at lunchtime, and then tonight at a bookstore in Salt Lake. But there really hasn't been a whole lot of publicity per se. They haven't really done any advertising yet. It's been a little bit in the Sunstone and some other places. So they've been happy with the response so far. So I guess they'll. I hope that they break even. I think that would be grand. Alan has promised that if it goes well, that they'll continue printing it. They'll look at a paperback version and so forth. I would like to get it in a form that would be inexpensive enough for lots of people to have access to it. Well, and see, that was kind of, the impetus for trying to get the church to do it is that, the church could mass produce it and make it available, and also having the church's endorsement would free the missionaries to be able to use it at their discretion when they come across people who can't read the authorized version. And, they should always give the authorized version, but if they have somebody who's having a problem, they could also use this to help people understand the authorized version. But, maybe down the road sometime something like that would happen. In the back.
Yeah, I got a comment and a question. The comment was, I remember one of the best experiences I ever had in the industry, you can't control
I think that certainly, the control issue is certainly probably the biggest bugaboo, at least at this juncture in the church. As I went through the Book of Mormon, quite honestly, there really weren't too many places where I would say that the meaning was ambiguous. There were two things that I found problematic for me personally. One was that, well, and this is just because I'm kind of, you know, anal retentive editor type person, and so what I called the ye problem drove me crazy, where a verse would start out with, you know, say King Lamoni is talking to Ammon or something, and he starts out, you know, thou wilt do this, or, you know, using thee, and then by the end of the verse he's saying ye, your. I hate that. I just, you know, I thought if the church was going to go back and change all the exceeding high mountains to exceedingly high mountains, darn it, couldn't they have had this problem fixed too, which I think is a greater problem when you don't have, you know, agreement how many people you're talking to. That seemed like a bigger problem. So that was just a nitpicky thing that really drove me crazy. And the other portion, which I really think is a problem, you know, and I find it the explanation is extremely unconvincing, is, you know, what do you do with a Benedict sermon? I mean, here's something that makes Jesus and the Father sound like the very same person. And, you know, I said in my Sunstone article that I was tempted at first to try to make some changes that would have the text reflect what we currently believe about God and Jesus being, that the Father and Jesus being two separate beings. Well, you know, that's not what a Benedict says. And all this stuff about, well, Jesus was being legally the Father, you know, all this, you know, legalese stuff. Well, you know, you can read in as much as you want. The problem is the text kind of says what it says. So, you know, apart from that, though, you know, there was Isaiah, you know, it wasn't so awful to paraphrase, though, quite frankly, I don't necessarily understand the Isaiah portions any better. You're still talking about all of these weird place names and so forth. That's, you either know that stuff or you don't, whether it's simple sentence structure or complex.
To be better, close this. Tina, you can talk to her after, but the tape.
Well, let's see. Let's see what we've got here. We go to 11 o'clock,
yeah.
And the other one doesn't start till 11:15, so why don't we let him finish his comment, okay. And then we'll...
But the tape's...
The tape's off. Well, that's probably just as well. Then you can ask me hard questions, and I won't be on the record. Well, thank you very much.